If you were reading a biography of Winston Churchill, and half of the book was dedicated to the last week of his life, you'd think, wait a minute, this is all out of proportion here. If you were reading a biography of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and half the book looked at the last week of his life, you'd scratch your head and think, wait one minute. Interestingly enough, the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, which focus on the life, the teachings of Jesus Christ, in the Gospel of Matthew, one-third of Matthew is devoted to the last week of Jesus' life. One-third of Mark looks at the last week of his life. One-fourth of Luke and one-half of the Gospel of John focuses specifically on the last week of Jesus' life. Now, I got off without my clicker. What did I do with that? It's got to be here somewhere. Here it is. Okay. Yeah, this is my magic wand. And if it doesn't work, we're all in trouble. What I want to do is take a look at the last week of Jesus' life. So much of what we have in the New Testament is devoted to that. And I want to walk through day by day what Jesus did, what he said. And you'll see I've tried to put a map of Jerusalem there so you can kind of put this spatially, geographically, where he was moving. And you can see here on Sunday, that would have been a week ago. We call this Palm Sunday. Jesus had his triumphal entry into Jerusalem. Choir was singing Hosanna. The people were there putting their coats, palm fronds down. It was a great day. Jesus gets into Jerusalem and he weeps. He weeps over the hardness of their hearts. He also predicts it's going to be destroyed. And we saw that happen. Well, we didn't see that happen, but we read about that. 70 AD, Roman armies surrounded Jerusalem. It was destroyed. Then in the evening, he heads out to a little town called Bethany. Now, if you were rating Jesus' day, good, bad, indifferent, I don't need to hear this, but I want you to be thinking, you know, was that a pretty good day? I'd give him, boy, an A on that. People were acclaiming him, applauding him. If I was his press secretary, I said, hey, keep this going. That was a great day. Let's take a look at Monday. Jesus heads back into Jerusalem, and on the way, he curses a fig tree because it doesn't have any fruit. Now, you hear that, and you're thinking, what is with that? What in the world? Well, we're going to come back to that. It's really an object lesson, as we're going to see in just a minute. He gets into Jerusalem, and there in the temple, where it was supposed to be an area dedicated to Gentiles. Gentiles could come, they could worship God. You know what's happened? There are all sorts of money changers who have set up their trade, people selling animals, doves, and Jesus, you know, he makes a whip, drives them out. He's incensed that God's house, what is supposed to be a house of prayer, has been turned into a place of commerce, a common place of commerce. The religious leaders get together and they say, we need to do something about him. It's stronger than that. They say, we need to kill him. We need to kill him. It would be better that one man die than that the whole nation be destroyed. In the evening, Jesus and the disciples return back to Bethany. What kind of a grade would you give him that day? You know, not bad, not bad. He did what needed to be done. Religious leaders should have taken care of this, which leads us to Tuesday. Tuesday, they're heading back into Jerusalem, and the disciples notice this fig tree that is withered now. The leaves are dry. It looks horrible. And Jesus tells them, if you believe God, and if you deal with unforgiveness in your heart, you can pray and God will answer. You can do things greater than this. The religious leaders then question Jesus' basis of authority, and he gives them a number of parables that are directed at them. These two sons, one who both are asked by their father, go work in the field, and one says, I will, but doesn't. One says, I won't, but does. Another parable, tenant farmers who are renting the land from the owner. It's time for them to pay their share. And the owner sends a number of servants, and they beat them and drive them off. Finally, the owner sends his son and says, certainly, they'll respect my son. They kill him and think, ah, now the farm is ours. And the religious leaders understand Jesus is talking about them and their animosity toward the prophets, that God has sent their animosity toward him. The Pharisees then ask Jesus a series of questions. They try to trap him in his words so that they will have reason to convict him, reason to say, you don't want to listen to him. Look at what he says. So they ask him, should we pay taxes to Caesar or not? And you know, that's a great question, because it's April 1st today, and in 14 more days, no, we won't even go there. Should we or should we not pay taxes? And Jesus says, show me a coin. And on the coin, there's a picture of Caesar. Jesus says, give to Caesar what belongs to him, and give to God what belongs to God. He asks, whose image is on the coin? It's Caesar's. Who bears God's image? It's us. We are made in the image and likeness of God. And Jesus is saying, yeah, we pay taxes, but you know, ultimately, we owe everything to our God, our Father in heaven. That was the Pharisees. The Sadducees, then, who didn't believe in a resurrection, they try to trap Jesus, and they spin out this tale of a woman who's married, and her husband dies, she marries his brother, he dies, all the way down through all seven brothers. That was the Jewish custom. If a man died without raising up children, his brother needed to marry. And then they say, okay, so this woman married all seven. In the resurrection, when they die, who will she be married to? And Jesus says, you don't understand. You don't understand the Bible. You know, that would be like saying to Billy Graham, did you ever read the Bible? Of course he did. He'd memorized huge chunks of it. These Sadducees, they knew their Bible, but they didn't understand it. And Jesus says, no. The Pharisees then, a Pharisee asked Jesus, what is the greatest commandment? And you could quote his answer along with me. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Love your neighbor as yourself. And Jesus says, you're not far. They've asked him three questions. He says, I've got a question for you. Here's my question. How can the Messiah be both the descendant of David and also David's Lord and God? Because he's a descendant of David, he comes through the lineage of David, but in the Psalms, David said, the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand. How can he be both a descendant and Lord and God? And if they had thought and searched out the answer to that, they would have known who he was, why he was there, what he was all about. Jesus then pronounces a series of woes, misery, trouble, sorrow, distress on the religious leaders, and he laments that the hearts of God's people are so hard. He's in the temple, he's sitting, and he's watching as a widow lady comes in, and she places two small copper coins, two mites, into the treasury there in the temple. And Jesus commends her. He tells the disciples, that's everything she had. She gave it all. Jesus commends her for doing that, even though the temple is corrupt and those who lead it are corrupt. Then he prays, God, Father God, glorify your name. And there's a voice, a response from heaven where his father says, I have glorified my name and I will continue to do that. As the disciples then are leaving the temple area, they're looking around at this huge structure and are overwhelmed by just how breathtaking it is, kind of like tourists. And they Jesus sees this and he says, a time is coming when not one stone will be left on another. It will all be torn down. And they say, when? When will this happen and what will be the sign? How can we know it? And Jesus goes into what is commonly called the Olivet Discourse, where he talks to them about the signs of the ends of the end of the age, wars, natural disasters, persecution, the abomination of desolation, false Christ, false prophets. And then he concludes by saying the Son of Man will come. And he gives a number of parables about the coming of the Son of Man that all have the same point. Keep your eyes open. Be alert. Be spiritually aware. Don't get lulled into a lethargic slumber. Then they leave. They go to the Mount of Olives and they spend the night there. That is Tuesday. Wednesday. By the way, how did he do on Tuesday? Yeah, you know, he gets into this with the Jewish religious leaders, but, you know, not all that bad. Wednesday, the Jewish religious leaders plot to kill Jesus. After what happened the day before, they say, we've got to get rid of him. Rather than losing the whole nation, he needs to die. And Judas, one of Jesus' disciples, goes over to the dark side. He reaches out to the Jewish chief priests and they bargain. He says, I will betray Jesus for 30 pieces of silver. Not a very good day. Thursday, Jesus sends Peter and John to prepare the upper room for the Passover meal. This is the Jewish religious feast celebrating what happened when God took all of his people who were slaves in Egypt, and you know, the plagues that struck Egypt, God makes a way for them to leave. The last plague, the killing of the firstborn son, and finally Pharaoh is persuaded, we need to get these people out of here. They celebrate that year by year by year. They have a Passover meal, a Passover Seder, still happens to this day. And Jesus sends Peter and John, go to this room and get ready for all of us, the disciples and Jesus, celebrating the Passover. As they gather together to celebrate Passover, Jesus washes the disciples' feet. I have a relative who grew up in a church, an assembly, where they washed each other's feet on a regular basis, monthly. Men washing men's feet, women washing women's feet. And I talked with him about this, and he said, yeah, whenever we did that, Saturday night, you knew what was happening in every house where people attend this church. They got out the power buffer and they're buffing, they're, you know, take the power sander, get the calluses off, perfume, powder, and on Sunday morning, when they come to church to have their feet washed, they're shiny, they're sparkling. Yeah, they just look immaculate, which kind of missed the whole point. Because back in Jesus' day, they wore open-toed sandals. And they walked on dirty, dusty roads, and there were camels and goats and sheep and horses that traveled those same roads, if you get my drift. I hope I don't have to get too graphic here. Their feet were filthy, and Jesus took a robe, took a basin, humbled himself and washed the feet of the disciples. That was the job. That was the task of the servant. In fact, it was even said, Jewish servants, that was so disgusting, they didn't have to wash the feet of guests. And yet here is Jesus, the Lord, the Master, the Teacher, and he is washing the filthy feet of his disciples. Then he gets up and says, I've left you an example. If this is how I treat you, how should you respond to one another? Their feet are washed. They have a Passover meal together. And Jesus invests this Passover meal with new meaning. The Jews, they were to be ready to leave at a moment's notice. And so they had unleavened bread, and they had their drink, their wine. Jesus takes the bread, he breaks it, and he says, "This represents my body, which is broken for you." He takes the wine, and he says, "This represents my blood, which is poured out for you." Then he speaks to them, this upper room discourse, John 14, 15, 16, 17. He tells them he's going away, but he says, "I'm going to send the Holy Spirit. I'm also going to give you my peace. I will not leave you as orphans." He urges them, "Abide in me," just like a vine abides, a branch abides in the vine. You can't do nothing. You can do nothing without me. So abide in me. Abide in my love. He warns them about persecutions and speaks about the Holy Spirit and what he will do. Then he prays for them. And in the middle of that, he prayed for you. Did you realize that 2,000 years ago, if you're a believer in Jesus Christ, he prayed for you. He says, "Father, I'm not just praying for these who are here, my followers. I'm praying for those who will hear about me because of their testimony." Jesus, the eternal Son of God, omnipotent, omniscient, 2,000 years ago, he prayed for you. He knew you. He prayed for you. They sing a song. And then Jesus and the disciples leave and go to the Mount of Olives, where he predicts that Peter is going to deny him three times. Jesus goes about 100, 200 feet away from his disciples. He tells them to pray. He kneels down in a garden. We know it as Gethsemane. And three times he prays that there would be another way to redeem sinful men and women, to bring them back to himself, to bring them to heaven. He prays, "Father, there has to be another way. Do I have to drink this cup?" And finally he gets up and he says, "Not my will, but yours be done." Judas leads a group of Roman soldiers, Jewish religious officials, and others who have torches and clubs and weapons and spears. He walks up to Jesus, gives him a kiss, and Jesus says, "Is this how you betray the Son of Man?" Peter, who was by trade a fisherman, grabs his sword, and we don't know where he aimed, but he ends up cutting off the ear of a man. Jesus heals the man, tells Peter, "Put away your sword. And at that point, all the disciples flee. They abandon Jesus. They leave him there in the custody of the Romans and the Jewish officials. That's Thursday. What kind of a grade would you give that day? Not so good. Not so good. That brings us to Friday. Friday. And this is early. This is probably just after midnight. All of those things went on during the evening, Thursday evening. Friday, early in the morning, Jesus has a preliminary hearing before the Jewish religious leader, Annas. And while that is going on, Peter, for the first time, denies that he knows Jesus. "I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know that man." Still early in the morning, Jesus is taken to the house of Caiaphas. And if I get behind, James, you keep me up to speed here. Taken to the house of Caiaphas, the Jewish high priest. And for a second time, Jesus is tried illegally. For a second time, Peter denies that he knows Jesus. After that, still early in the morning, Jesus is taken before the entire Jewish ruling council, the religious ruling council known as the Sanhedrin. He is tried there, and for a third time, he denies that he knows, Peter denies that he knows Jesus. Immediately, the rooster crows. Jesus looks, he gets Peter's gauge. And Peter recognizes what he has done. And the Gospels record he leaves and he weeps bitterly. Peter, who thought he would be the last to turn, the last to go, the last to run. After that, Jesus is tried before Pilate. And we read it's during that time that Judas went out and killed himself. Jesus is then tried before Herod. He's taken to Herod's palace, and he doesn't say a thing. He is sent back to Pilate, who declares his innocence. There's a further trial that goes on with Pilate, who offers to release Jesus. There was a Jewish custom at the Feast of Passover. Pilate, the governor, would release a prisoner. And he offers Jesus as the prisoner to be released. But the Jewish religious leaders incite the crowd, and they cry out for a man named Barabbas. Barabbas, which literally means son of the father. Son of the father. He was an insurrectionist. He led a rebellion. He'd been jailed. He was set to be killed. How about if I release to you Barabbas, the son of the father? But they cry all the louder, no, no. Set him free. What should I do with Jesus? Pilate asks. And they shout, crucify him, crucify him, crucify him. Pilate brings out a basin of water. He washes his hands. He says, I'm innocent. He releases Barabbas and gives Jesus to the Roman soldiers to be scourged. We're going to talk a little bit more about that. Ultimately, hands him over to be crucified. At that point, the soldiers are in charge of Jesus, the Roman soldiers. They mock him. They put a crown of thorns on his head. They take a stick and blindfold him and beat him with the stick. They hit him with their fists. They pull out his beard. They say, hey, if you're really who you claim to be, tell us. Who did that? Who did that? And as Isaiah said, like a lamb before his shearers is dumb, he didn't open up his mouth. Ultimately, after being mocked, he's led away to Golgotha. Literally means the place of the skull. It's now around 9 in the morning. They offer Jesus some wine mixed with a analgesic to numb the pain, and he refuses it. They stretch out his hands and nail spikes through his wrists and nail one more through his feet, perhaps his ankles. Jesus then is raised up on the cross. It drops into a hole in the ground. And he, at that point, says, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing. As he's saying that, the Roman soldiers are gambling for his tunic. It's one piece, and they don't want to rip it. This is in fulfillment. So everything here is in fulfillment of what Scripture said. If you haven't read Psalm 22 lately, read it this afternoon, where it talks about this very thing. All his bones out of joint, gambling for his clothes. The crowds, the Jewish leaders, the soldiers mock Jesus, and they dare him. Hey, prove to us that you're really who you claim to be. If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross. It is so ironic that no sooner has he been nailed to the cross, they're clamoring, come down. And I think that may be induced by Satan, who realizes, oh, I made a bad call here. I need to get him down. I don't really want him to die. One of the felons, there are two criminals. Many Bibles translate it thieves. That is way too weak a translation. They were hardened criminals. They were career criminals. The Romans only crucified those who were rebels trying to overthrow the state or career criminals. And Jesus is crucified between two felons, two career criminals. One mocks him as well, while the other listens to what he says, watches how he behaves, repents of his life of crime, and puts his faith in Jesus Christ. And Jesus says to him, this very day, you will be with me in paradise. Jesus looks down, sees his mother, Mary, standing there, and next to her, one of his disciples, John. And he says to John, this is your mother. He says to Mary, his mother, this is your son. Takes care, discharges the obligation as the oldest son to care for his mother. It's 3 p.m. and the sky grows black. And this is not a natural kind of darkness. In fact, Luke writes this, the sun's light failed. The sun's light failed. And at 3 p.m. in the blackness, Jesus cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? Every time in the scriptures that Jesus addresses his Father, he always says, Father, Father. There's only one time Jesus does not call God his Father. And it's right here as he's hanging on the cross. And as the sins of the world have been placed on him, he who knew no sin was made sin for us. And the Father turns his back, and the sky goes dark, and the sun refuses to shine. And Jesus, alienated from God, Jesus separated from the Father. How could that happen? I can't answer that. How one member of the Holy Trinity could be excluded from the others. That is a mystery that I cannot answer. But Jesus becomes sin for us and in despair cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? The next thing he says, I am thirsty. Whoops, I got ahead of myself there. I am thirsty. And I don't think Jesus is giving us an account of his physical needs right then. It is so interesting. Everywhere in the writings of John, the Gospel of John, 1st and 2nd, 3rd John, the book of Revelation, anywhere where John uses this word thirst, I am thirsty, it's always indicative of a spiritual need. It's always indicative of someone who is estranged from God, and there's an inner longing, an inner thirst that can't be satisfied in any way, try as they might. Jesus talking to the woman at the well, who says, I have something that can satisfy your thirst. Book of Revelation, Jesus says, anyone who's thirsty, come to me, drink freely of the water of life. I don't think Jesus here is speaking about what's going on the inside as much, or on the outside, as much as he is what is going on the inside. And he feels like that woman at the well right now, because he took her sin on himself. He is separated from his Father, and there's a longing that has never been there for all eternity in the heart of the Son of God, alienated, separated from his Father. He then says, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit, and cries out, it is completed, it is finished. And when he dies, the curtain of the temple is torn in two. There's a powerful earthquake. Graves are open, and godly men and women who died trusting in the Father, they come out of their graves. They go into Jerusalem. They talk about what has just happened. Seeing all of this, the Roman centurion who is standing there, who has overseen the crucifixion of Jesus, he cries out, surely, surely this was an innocent man. Surely this was God's son. The soldiers then break the legs of the two criminals, and one comes and pierces Jesus through his side. There have been many ways that people have tried to escape the conclusion that Jesus died and rose again. One of them that was published in 1828 by a man named Paulus, he said Jesus never died. Jesus never died. He only appeared to die, but he didn't really die. He passed out. They thought he was dead. They took him down from the cross. They put him in a tomb where it's cool, it's dark. He comes around. And somehow he escapes. He goes back. He finds the disciples and they say, "You're alive. We saw you die." And it was a mistake from the beginning. Another man in 1970s by the name of Hugh Schoenfeld, he wrote another book similar called The Passover Plot, where he says much the same thing. The first problem with that, nobody in Jesus' day ever would have thought that was even had the smallest possibility of happening. Those who watched the process of Roman crucifixion, they knew that could never happen. The two prominent men who put this theory forward, they both live 1800s, 1900s. They were not there to watch the process of scourging, where the prisoner's arms were tied above his head to a pole, and one or two Roman soldiers, they had a whip with multiple leather thongs, and at the end of each of those leather thongs, there was a ball of lead or a piece of bone, and they would repeatedly rake that around his body, his back, and it would literally pull the flesh off and expose the muscle, the sinews, even the organs. And they knew how to scourge a man within an inch of his life, but not kill him. They'd cut the prisoner down, and most of the time they couldn't walk. They could barely crawl. It was so horrific. The loss of blood, to say nothing else, was just unbelievable. Jesus was scourged. Then they put the crossbeam on his shoulders, and he couldn't carry that. He was so weak, so exhausted at this point. So they had another man carry the cross to Golgotha, which literally means the place of the skull. And then they nailed through the wrists, nailed his hands to the cross, nailed his feet to the cross, lifted it up, put it in the ground, and that's when the cycle starts, because he's hanging there by his arms, and the pressure it puts on the lung cavity becomes more and more difficult to breathe, and ultimately he has to pull with spiked arms, push with spiked feet, raise himself up again, take a breath, and then he exhaustedly sinks back down again. And this goes on and on and on, cycle after cycle, hour after hour after hour. That's why they broke the legs of the two criminals, because they couldn't push themselves up anymore. They would die of asphyxiation. The Roman soldiers were experts at judging when someone was dead. But they put a spear through his side, and John says blood and water flowed out. There's a sac around our hearts, the pericardial sac, which has a fluid in it. And I think it indicates they pierced the pericardium. They also pierced his heart, and blood flowed out. Joseph, after Jesus died, Joseph of Arimathea went to Pilate, asked for permission. "I'd like to bury the body of Jesus." And Pilate gave it to him. He and another Jewish religious official, Nicodemus, took down the body of Jesus. Now, the way that they, burial practice in that day, they would take a strip of linen and tie both hands together. They would take another strip, tie the ankles together, And then they'd take yard after yard after yard of linen and wrap the body. And while they're wrapping, they would intersperse all sorts of spices. John says they took myrrh and aloes, probably a thick liquid ointment, and interspersed that amongst the linen wrappings, 75 pounds worth. Once the body was wrapped, Joseph, it was his tomb, brand new tomb. He took Jesus, placed him in the new tomb, and a huge stone was rolled into a depression. A huge stone sealed the entrance. It takes more faith than I have to believe that Jesus wasn't dead, and that in a condition like that, he was able to tear apart his bound hands and feet, extricate himself from the layer after layer after layer of linen wrappings, able to push the stone out of the way, overpower the Roman guards, walk miles on legs that were pierced, feet that were pierced, and then appear to his disciple as the risen Lord of life, rather than as someone who desperately needed immediate medical attention. This theory makes Jesus one of the greatest moral teachers the world has ever known, nothing more than a deceiving charlatan. That was Friday. That was Friday. Let's move to Saturday. I forgot to put Saturday. You know what? The Bible doesn't say anything about the disciples. It doesn't say anything about Jesus. Saturday is silent. In fact, the only thing we do read, the Jewish religious leaders went to Pilate and said, "We need a guard on the tomb because this man talked about rising again, and we don't want the disciples going and stealing his body." So Pilate orders that the tomb be guarded and sealed. Where are the disciples? There's no word. There is no word about them. My best guess is they were hidden away somewhere in fear that there's going to be a knock at the door, they're going to find Roman soldiers there or Jewish officials there, and they're going to be the next ones to die. They had just watched Jesus die an agonizing death. Where's Jesus during this time? We don't know for sure, but the Bible gives some intimations. In 1 Peter 3:18, Peter writes, "Christ also suffered once for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous, that he might bring us to God, being put to death in the flesh, but made alive in his spirit, in which he went and proclaimed to the spirits in prison." You can track this down. That little phrase, spirits in prison, is always used of angels or fallen angels, demons. And proclaim, it's not the word go and preach that is usually used. It's the word of just sharing news. And I think Peter here gives us insight that after he died, Jesus at some point went to the place where these demons were, fallen angels who had sinned in the days of Noah. Jude talks about this in Jude verse 6. They were being held captive. And they're wondering if Satan is going to overpower Jesus, and Satan is going to come and set them loose from these chains that have held them for centuries. And they hear some stirring, they think, maybe it is. And then they hear the voice of the Son of God proclaiming his victory over sin and death, and yes, Satan himself. So what did Jesus do? I think he proclaimed his victory over fallen angels, and then he took the saints who had died believing in God, following God. He took them with him into heaven, returned to the acclamation of the holy angels. But there's not a word of him doing anything here on earth on Saturday. From the perspective of the disciples, Jesus was dead and gone. You think, wait a minute. No, the disciples, they knew he was coming back. He told them. He had told them. He told them repeatedly. But again and again and again, they didn't get it. You can read this afternoon. Matthew 16, verse 21. Mark 9, a couple of times in that chapter. It says, Jesus told them, but they didn't believe him. They did not believe him. They woke up Saturday morning, and the nightmare of Friday night still clung tightly to them. They woke up Saturday morning and the sky was still black for them. They still heard the mocking taunts. Saturday, the shame of abandoning their Lord in his hour of greatest need still stabbed their hearts. Saturday, their weakness, their cowardice, their fear still shook their self-confidence. Saturday, Peter is still weeping bitterly. Saturday, they have no understanding of why Judas did what he did. Saturday, Jesus questioned, my God, why have you forsaken me? It still goes without any answer. Saturday is sorrow without solace. It's despair without hope. It's the overwhelming victory of evil, the unthinking, unthinkable defeat of good. It's death without life. Saturday is hell because Jesus is dead. That was Saturday. But Sunday comes. Sunday comes. Here's what we read. The women followers of Jesus are the first to go to the tomb to anoint the dead body of Jesus. They're taking spices that they will put on his dead body. They do not believe he was coming back to life again. But unexpectedly, the women meet the risen Christ. Matthew 28, Jesus met them saying, greetings. They came to him, held on to his feet and worshiped him. Jesus said, do not be afraid. Go and tell my brothers I'm going to Galilee. They'll see me there. And so the women do just that. They go back to the disciples and they tell them, we just saw the Lord. And the disciples, here's what Luke says. These words seemed like pure nonsense to the disciples. Pure nonsense. And they did not believe them. There's a problem with these texts I've just told you about. Because women, in Jewish society, women were not allowed to give testimony in a court of law. Women were universally regarded as undependable. They couldn't get the truth straight, unreliable. And so they couldn't give testimony in a court of law. Some people say, the Bible, it's full of errors, it's full of myths, it's been made up. Jesus' followers got together, who knows, 50 years after he died, 100 years later, they put these stories together, they made them up. They never would have made this up, because if you want a credible witness to the greatest event in human history, you'd have a man. You'd have a number of men. You would not have women there as the first to see and hear the risen Christ. And you definitely would not have Mary Magdalene. Mary Magdalene, out of whom Jesus cast 7 demons. We don't know a whole lot about her life, but I know this. She probably was not on most lawyers. She probably was not on any lawyer's list to be a character witness after the life that she had lived. Now, some have said, okay, they thought they saw Jesus, but they really didn't see Jesus. These were all hallucinations. All the appearances, they were just hallucinations. You study hallucinations, and they only happen to people who really expect them to happen. They want them to happen. For example, a mother whose son was killed, IED in Afghanistan, and she misses him so much. She wishes he were here. She looks at his picture. She talks to his picture, and one afternoon, she sees him. She sees him there. She expected that he would come back and talk to her. She was looking for that. As we have seen, that was not the case with Jesus' disciples. That was not the case with the women. They were all surprised. They were not expecting. They were going to anoint the dead body of Jesus, not see him alive. Hallucinations are individual. They're different for each person. But Jesus appeared to groups, 10, 12, 500 at one time. They all saw him at the same time. It was inside and out, men and women, day and night. These were not hallucinations. They were appearances of the risen Jesus Christ. The Roman guards and the Jewish leaders concoct then an explanation for the missing body of Christ. The guards go and tell the Jews, the tomb is empty. We don't know what happened. And the Jews say, okay, you say this, that while you were asleep, the disciples came and they stole his body. And if word gets higher up, we'll make sure nothing happens. This was the first explanation for the empty tomb. And a man named Eusebius of Caesarea, he mocked it. This was in the 300s. He said, so let's imagine that some of the disciples, they got together and they said, hey, let's invent all the miracles and the resurrection appearances that we never saw. Let's make them up. Let's carry the sham even to our death. Why not die for nothing? Why not die for nothing? Why should we not like torture, whipping, inflicted for no good reason? Let's go out to all the nations, overthrow their institutions, and denounce their gods. And even if we don't convince anyone, at least we'll have the satisfaction of drawing down on ourselves the punishment for our own deceit. He's mocking this idea. He's saying, can you imagine them even having a discussion like that? And so Peter suggests it. Yeah, let's all go and be horribly, horribly treated just like Jesus was. And the rest say, oh yeah, that sounds great. I'm in. It's ludicrous. It's ludicrous. It would be like my saying, last night, Pastor Andrew came and stole our coffee maker right out of our kitchen while we were all sleeping. He came and he stole the coffee maker. Well, first thing, you got to know Andrew, who is wonderful. He's godly. He is a good man. Something like that would never cross his mind. Then you got to know how often you see Andrew with coffee. You don't. He doesn't drink it. Yeah. And then he stole it while we were asleep. If I was asleep, I wouldn't know that Andrew came and stole my coffee maker. It was probably Brad, you know, for all I know. Yeah, this was the first explanation, and again, it is just, it's utterly ludicrous. Sunday concludes. Jesus appears to two disciples on the road to Emmaus. And you know that story. They are dejected. They are distraught. And they invite him to dinner. And while he's breaking bread, they recognize. And he disappears. He goes back to Jerusalem, appears to the disciples without Thomas. Thomas is not there. Appears to his disciples, and he says, look, they think he's a ghost. He says, touch me. Ghost doesn't have flesh and blood like I do. Give me something to eat. They give him a piece of fish, and he eats it. And a week later, a week from this Sunday, Thomas is there with them. He appears again. Jesus says, come here, Thomas. Thomas had said, I won't believe unless I can put my finger in the prints of the nail, unless I can put my hand in the side. Jesus says, come here. Stop your believing. Touch me and believe. And Thomas falls on his face and says, my Lord and my God. Did the disciples steal Jesus' body? It's unthinkable. They were cowering, shaking in fear behind locked doors. Nobody would even have thought that. Were the appearances only hallucinations? Absolutely not. Did Jesus only apparently die? Did he fake his own death? Absolutely not. Some, in our day and age, they talk about, yeah, he rose again, but it was a spiritual resurrection. His body didn't rise again. In fact, there are churches today where you will hear things like this. These stories were all written in a pre-scientific age where they believed in miracles and angels and things like that. They believed the earth was flat. We know better today. And you know what? It doesn't really matter whether Jesus rose again literally or not. He may have died and stayed dead. What does matter is if you believe that he rose again. That's what matters. If he's alive in your heart, if his example is still fresh in your soul, and you strive every day to live in a gracious, accepting way, face the world with courage just like Jesus did, maintain hope no matter what happens. But the records of the original writers don't leave us room for an interpretation like that. They touched him. They held his feet. They watched him eat. Jesus rose again physically from the dead. There's no good explanation for the change in the disciples who 40 days later were boldly proclaiming the resurrection of Jesus Christ in the face of those who were his enemies. There's no good explanation for that. There's no good explanation for the appearances except that he rose again. There's no good explanation for the origin of the Christian faith. Why is there worship on Sunday instead of Saturday? Why do we have a New Testament? Why is there a Christian church without the resurrection? There's no reason for that. There is no good explanation for the empty tomb if Jesus did not rise from the dead. We've seen here, as we look at the last week, people who are antagonistic, people who are skeptical, people who are undecided, and people who believed. Where are you? Where are you on that spectrum? If you have never put your faith in the resurrected Christ, I would urge you, do that today. Do that today. Recognize that just like all the disciples, just like Mary Magdalene, just like me, we are all sinners, and there's no way we can work our way back to God. There's no way we could ever earn a place in heaven, no matter how good we might try to be. God knew that, and that's why Jesus came. The whole point of the crucifixion was he took on himself my punishment for the sins I've committed. He took my place. He was my substitute and yours. All I have to do now is put my trust in him and receive all of his righteousness in place of all of my sin, my wickedness, my rebellion. Receive his life, not just the natural life I was given. If you've never done that, right now, today, say to God, I recognize I'm a sinner and I thank you for the gift of your son. And today, I am trusting in Jesus Christ alone. Let's pray.